Welcome to a special holiday edition of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. On this show, we'll spend the full hour listening to journalist Chris Hedges speak about his new book, America, The Farewell Tour, recorded at the Sanctuary for Independent Media on November 3rd, 2018. Full audio and video of this talk, including the question and answer period that followed, is available online at mediasanctuary.org. First, we'll hear the introduction by Hudson Mohawk Magazine correspondent Megan Marone.
Chris and I met in Zuccotti Park in the fall of 2011 as Occupy Wall Street was unfolding. And in that moment, I told him that I taught at Chatham High School in Chatham, New Jersey. And Chatham is an upper crust, predominantly conservative Wall Street bedroom community. Chris knew Chatham and some of the more stifling aspects of the social and cultural dynamics within this community. And immediately he recited to me lines that he has memorized from the poem September 1st, 1939 by W.H. Auden. And the lines are, "Faces along the bar cling to their average day. The lights must never go out. The music must always play. All the conventions conspire to make this fort assume the furniture of home. Lest we should see where we are, lost in a haunted wood, children afraid of the night, who have never been happy or good." Chris agreed to come to the school and do a presentation for our philosophy club. And he spoke to the students very kindly and gently, but he also was very truthful, and he didn't conceal his critique of the pathologies of our civilization. In that time, several of my colleagues and I had been fighting to keep explicitly ideologically challenging materials and texts on the curriculum, and we would often show our students the film The Examined Life by Astra Taylor. And in the film, one of Chris's very good friends, Cornel West, describes why we should challenge the notion that America was ever the paradisial city on the hill. And his exact quote from the film is, "America's a romantic project, but also a fragile democratic experiment predicated on the dispossession of the lands of indigenous peoples, the enslavement of African peoples, the subjugation of women, and the marginalization of gays and lesbians. That has great potential, but this notion that we had it all or that we ever will have it all, it's got to go." What's strange about our time is that in the face of incipient fascist tendencies, any romantic notions are falling away, whether we want them to or not. There's no going back from what we have known and what we have seen. We can't turn away from the danger that the decline of the American empire poses to us and to the rest of the world. But I guess in terms of my own personal quest for meaning, I always come back to the question of where love comes into the picture. The Vietnamese monk Thich Nhat Hanh has an easy test for the presence of true love in relationships. He invites people to examine any interaction or relationship and ask four questions. Does this dynamic have loving kindness? Is there equanimity between us? Do we feel compassion for each other? How do we give each other joy? Perhaps the gift of Chris naming the forces that are consuming our love and humanity, especially right now, and inflicting psychic, physical, emotional, and sexual assaults on our bodies and minds is that we can scramble to find love in the midst of the chaos of this empire decline. He names our condition, and from the umbrella of darkness, perhaps we can ask who's keeping the light on and who's bringing us joy. How can we bring joy to the table under the darkness? Who's treating people compassionately? Who, in eagle-eyed, truthful vision of other people's flaws, still doles out love? And who still finds ways to be of service? We don't have much time, and maybe we need a ritual. In a song about end times, my favorite musician and muse, Joanna Newsom, people have to hear me talk about all the time, she crafts a ritual. She suggests in the song, these are her lyrics and the recipe for her ritual for love. "Stand here and name the ones you loved beneath the drifting ashes, and in the naming rise above time as it flashing passes. Let's, as a ritual tonight, right now, listen to Chris together, and then name who and what we love, and vow to fight for who and what we love together."
As I've mentioned, I think every time I've come here, I grew up not far from here in Schoharie, Schoharie, New York, on Main Street. My father had the old red brick church, and we grew up in the house next door. I'm a slouter at heart. You have to be from Schoharie Valley to know what that is. The French sociologist Emile Durkheim, in his book On Suicide, examined the disintegration of social bonds that drive individuals and societies to personal and collective acts of self-destruction. He found that when social bonds were strong, individuals achieve a healthy balance between individual initiative, self-actualization, and communal solidarity, which he called a life-sustaining equilibrium. These individuals and communities, he noted, have the lowest rates of suicide. The individuals and societies most susceptible to self-destruction, he wrote, are those for whom these social bonds, this equilibrium, have been shattered. Societies are held together by a web of social bonds that give individuals a sense of being part of a collective and engaged in a project larger than the self. This collective expresses itself through meaningful work, democratic participation, worship, and even patriotism, as well as shared national beliefs and values. These social bonds provide meaning, a sense of purpose, status, and dignity. They offer psychological protection from impending mortality and the meaningless that comes with being isolated and rejected. The disintegration of these social bonds plunges individuals into deep psychological distress that leads ultimately to acts of collective and individual self-annihilation. Durkheim called this state of hopelessness and despair anomie, which he defined as rulelessness. Rulelessness means the norms that govern a society and create a sense of organic solidarity no longer function. The belief, for example, that if we work hard, obey the law, and get a good education, we can achieve stable employment, social status, and mobility, along with financial security, is no longer true. The old rules that were imperfect and usually excluded poor people of color, nevertheless, were not a complete fiction in the United States. They offered some Americans, especially those from the white, working, and middle class, modest social and economic advancement. But the capture of political and economic power by corporate elites, along with the redirecting of all institutions toward the further consolidation of their power and wealth, has broken the social bonds that held American society together. This rupture has unleashed a widespread malaise and self-destructiveness that Durkheim would have recognized. When society is strongly integrated, he wrote, it keeps individuals in a state of dependency, holding them to be in its service, and consequently not permitting them to dispose of themselves as they wish. Society is thus opposed to them escaping from their obligations toward it through death. The bond that attaches them to their common purpose attaches them to life. And in any case, the high goal towards which their gaze is turned alleviates the suffering that they feel from life's troubles. Finally, in a coherent and vital community, there is a continual exchange of ideas and feelings, from all to each and from each to all, which is like a mutual moral support, so that the individual, instead of being reduced to his or her resources only, participates in the collective energy and draws on it when his own is extinguished. Our corporate coup d'etat and failed democracy has freed the oligarchic elite from all legal and moral constraints. The state of disorganization or anomy is thus reinforced by the fact that passions are less disciplined at the very time when they need stronger discipline, Durkheim noted of the avarice of the rich. It is not for nothing that so many religions have celebrated the benefits and the moral value of poverty, Durkheim wrote. This is because, of all schools, it is the one that best teaches humankind to restrain itself. By obliging us to exercise constant discipline over ourselves, it prepares us to accept collective discipline with docility, while wealth, by exalting the individual, constantly risks awakening the spirit of rebellion that is the very font of immortality. Professors Martin Gillens and Benjamin Page, in their study of legislative laws, wrote, "The central point that emerges from our research is that economic elites and organized groups representing business interests have substantial independent impacts on U.S. government policy, while mass-based interest groups and average citizens have little or no independent influence." In essence, the electoral process is a facade, one where, as we will see this week, we get to choose between the friendly and inclusive form of corporate fascism under the Democratic Party, or the raw, racist, Christian fascism of Donald Trump's white man's party. The economic structures, like the political structures, have been reconfigured to keep the working class in a state of constant distress. American productivity, as the New York Times pointed out, has increased 77% since 1973. But hourly pay has grown only 12%. If the federal minimum wage was attached to productivity, the newspaper noted, it would be more than $20 an hour, not $7.25. Some 41.7 million workers, a third of the American workforce, earn less than $12 an hour, and most of them do not have access to employer-sponsored health insurance. A decade after the 2008 financial meltdown, the Times wrote, "The average middle-class family's net worth is more than $40,000 below what it was in 2007, and the net worth of black families is down 40%, and for Latino families, the figure has dropped to 46%. The financial crisis of 2008 saw the world's central banks, including the Federal Reserve, inject trillions of dollars of fabricated money into the global financial system. The Federal Reserve, which is supposed to regulate banks alone, handed over an estimated $29 trillion of fabricated money to American banks, according to researchers at the University of Missouri. $29 trillion. Kevin Zees and Margaret Flowers on the website Popular Resistance wrote, "One-sixth of this could provide a $12,000 annual basic income. which would cost $3.8 trillion annually. Doubling Social Security payments to $22,000 annually, which would cost $662 billion. A $10,000 bonus for all U.S. public school teachers, which would cost $11 billion. Free college for all high school graduates, which would cost $318 billion. And universal preschool, which would cost $38 billion. National improved Medicare for all would actually save the nation trillions of dollars over a decade. Now, the Fed and other central banks cut interest rates to near zero. And indeed, some central banks in Europe instituted negative interest rates, meaning they would pay borrowers to take loans. The Fed, in a clever bit of accounting, even permitted distressed banks to use these no-interest loans to buy U.S. Treasury bonds. So the banks gave the bonds back to the Fed and received a 0.25% interest from the Fed. In short, the banks were loaned money at virtually no interest by the Fed and then were paid interest by the Fed on the money they borrowed. The Fed also bought up worthless derivatives and other toxic assets from the banks. Since Fed authorities could fabricate as much money as they wanted, it did not matter if what they were buying was worthless. This fabricated money over the last decade has created a worldwide debt of $325 trillion, more than three times global GDP. The fabricated money was hoarded by banks and corporations, loaned by banks at predatory interest rates, used to service interest on unsustainable debt, or spent buying back stock, providing billions in compensation for the ruling elites. The fabricated money was not provided to the victims of financial fraud, but the victimizers. It was not invested in the real economy. Products were not manufactured and sold. Workers were not reinstated into the middle class with sustainable incomes, benefits, and pensions. Infrastructure projects were not undertaken. The fabricated money reinflated massive financial bubbles built on debt and papered over a fatally diseased financial system destined again for collapse. The criminal irresponsibility of the elites was simply perpetrated on an even more massive scale. What will trigger the next crash? The $13.2 trillion in US household debt? The $1.5 trillion in student debt? The billions Wall Street has invested in a fracking industry that has spent $280 billion more than it generated from its operations? Who knows? What is certain is that a global financial crash, one that will dwarf the meltdown of 2008, is inevitable. But this time, with interest rates near zero, the elites have no plan B. The financial structure will disintegrate, and the global economy will go into a death spiral. The rage of a betrayed and impoverished population will, I fear, further empower right-wing demagogues who promise vengeance on the global elites, moral renewal, and a nativist revival. Heralding a return to a mythical time when immigrants, women, and people of color knew their place, and most probably in the United States, a Christianized fascism. Given the staggering amount of fabricated money that has to be repaid, the banks need to build greater and greater pools of debt. This is why when you are late in paying your credit card, the interest rates jump to 28%. This is why if you declare bankruptcy, you are still responsible for paying off student loans, even as 1 million people a year default on these loans, with 40% of all borrowers expected to default by 2023. This is why wages are stagnant or have declined, while costs from healthcare and pharmaceutical products to bank fees and basic utilities keep skyrocketing. This is why the federal government, further stripped of $1.5 trillion over the next decade by the Trump tax cuts, will soon pay more in interest on its debt than it spends on the military, Medicaid, or children's programs combined. Within a decade, more than $900 billion in interest payments will be due annually. Interest on debt is now the fastest growing major government expense. The cost of interest will hit $390 billion next year, nearly 50% more than in 2017, according to the Congressional Budget Office. The global financial system is a ticking time bomb. The question is not if it will explode, but when it will explode. And once it does, the inability of the global speculators to use fabricated money with zero interest to paper over the debacle will trigger massive unemployment, high prices for imports and basic services, and very probably a devaluation of the dollar, especially when it is dropped as the world's reserve currency. No one knows when this will happen, although the historian Alfred McCoy says the American empire as we know it will no longer exist by 2030. The manufactured financial tsunami will transform the United States, already a failed democracy, into an authoritarian police state awash in weapons and driven by hate. Life will become cheap, especially for the vulnerable, undocumented workers, Muslims, poor people of color, girls and women, anti-capitalist and anti-imperialist critics branded as agents of a foreign power. All will be demonized and persecuted for the collapse. And the ruling elites, in a desperate bid to cling to their unchecked power and obscene wealth, will sanction indiscriminate violence against any group or individual they fear could instigate a revolt. Empires in decay, ravaged by widespread enemy, embrace an almost willful suicide. Blinded by their hubris and unable to face the reality of their diminishing power, they retreat into a fantasy world where hard and unpleasant facts no longer intrude. They replace diplomacy, multilateralism, and participatory politics with a constant mobilization against enemies, real or invented. This self-delusion saw the United States make the greatest strategic blunder in its history, one that sounded the death knell of the empire, the invasion of Afghanistan and Iraq. The architects of the war in the George W. Bush White House and the array of useful idiots in the press and academia who were cheerleaders for it, all of whom kept their prominent public platforms, knew very little about the countries being invaded, were stunningly naive about the effects of industrial warfare, and were blindsided by the ferocious blowback. They stated and probably believed that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction, although they had no valid evidence to support this claim. They insisted that democracy would be implanted in Baghdad and spread across the Middle East. They assured the public that U.S. troops would be greeted by grateful Iraqis and Afghans as liberators. They promised that the oil revenues would cover the cost of reconstruction. They insisted that the bold and quick military strike, shock and awe, would restore American hegemony in the region and dominance in the world. It did the opposite. Historians of empire call these military fiascos a feature of all late empires, micromilitarism. The Athenians engaged in micromilitarism when, during the Peloponnesian War, they invaded Sicily, suffering the loss of 200 ships and thousands of soldiers and triggering revolts throughout the empire. Britain, engaged in micromilitarism in 1956 when it attacked Egypt in a dispute over the nationalization of the Suez Canal and then quickly withdrew in humiliation, empowering a string of Arab nationalist leaders such as Gamal Abdel Nasser, and dooming the British rule over the nation's few remaining colonies. Neither of these empires recovered. Empires, because they rely on the power to dominate and exploit other countries, are in fact very fragile, and once this ability to dominate is taken from them, they unravel swiftly. A year for Portugal, 2 years for the Soviet Union, 8 years for France, 11 years for the Ottomans, 17 for Great Britain, and in all likelihood, 27 years for the United States, counting from the crucial 2003 when the U.S. invaded Iraq. Empires at the same time hollow themselves out from the inside. Their cities fall into decay. The decline sees the brutality abroad matched by a brutality at home. Militarized police gun down mostly unarmed poor people of color and fill a system of penitentiaries and jails that hold a staggering 25% of the world's prisoners, although America represents only 5% of the global population. The population at home, like the subjugated population abroad, lives under wholesale surveillance. Public services, including public education, infrastructure, public transportation, become decrepit and dysfunctional. This rulelessness, this anomie, is best seen in the two strata of the nation's judiciary. There is an aggressive criminalization of the poor, while the ruling elites are given virtual immunity. Protected by high-priced lawyers and non-enforcement or rewriting of laws. Amid selective enforcement of laws in the ruleless society, the high rollers on Wall Street and in wealthy enclaves are not prosecuted for possessing and ingesting illegal drugs, but the poor are thrown into prison and must forfeit all their property for being caught with small amounts of the same drugs. I live in Princeton, New Jersey, and I am sure there are as many drugs and probably of better quality in Princeton than there are in Trenton or in Troy. But police in Kevlar vests, armed with long-barreled weapons, are not kicking in Princeton doors at 2 a.m. to terrorize families over a nonviolent drug warrant. HSBC, the world's seventh largest bank by total assets, after admitting to laundering $800 million for Central and South American drug cartels, was slapped with symbolic fines and a deferred prosecution agreement, which is the legal equivalent of a get-out-of-jail-free card. The poor, meanwhile, are hounded, arrested, and fined for absurdly criminalized activities such as not mowing their lawns, loitering, selling loose cigarettes, although Eric Garner was not, when he was murdered, selling loose cigarettes, carrying open containers of alcohol, or obstructing pedestrian traffic, which means standing on a sidewalk. These fines are used to fill state and county budget shortfalls resulting from corporations and the wealthy fixing the rules to avoid paying meaningful taxes if they pay taxes at all. And remember, under Eisenhower, the wealthiest individuals and corporations paid 91%. This virtual tax boycott by the rich has broken yet another vital social bond, the idea that everyone contributes a significant portion of his or her income to make the society function. The elites who sacrifice nothing for society and are not held accountable for their criminal behavior live in what Matt Taibbi calls a stateless archipelago, or what a writer for The New Yorker called Richistan. They are legally empowered to pillage the nation, amass obscene wealth, and wield unchecked political and legal control. Brett Kavanaugh, aside from most probably being a sexual predator, is, as Ralph Nader said, a corporation masquerading as a human being. The result has been the obliteration of the primary social bonds that, however biased in favor of the white majority, once held the nation together. The shattering of these bonds has left tens of millions of Americans adrift. Society, Durkheim wrote, is no longer sufficiently present for these individuals. Those cast aside can participate in the society, as Durkheim wrote, only through sadness. The self-destructive pathologies that plague the United States, opioid addiction, morbid obesity, gambling, suicide, sexual sadism, we are a pornified culture, hate groups, and mass shootings rise out of this enemy. And my new book, America, the Farewell Tour, is an examination of these pathologies and that enemy that fuels this self-destructiveness. Now, Durkheim noted that the poor have lower rates of suicide. The poor know the rules are rigged against them. James Baldwin made much the same point when he wrote that African American men are less prone to a midlife crisis than white American men because they are less susceptible to the myth of the American dream. Most African Americans learn very early in life that there are two sets of rules, one for blacks and one for whites. But white Americans, because of white supremacy, are more susceptible to the myth and therefore more infuriated when the myth is exposed as a lie. And this, I suspect, is why nearly all mass shootings and all members of right-wing hate groups, along with a majority of supporters of Donald Trump, are white men. Capitalism, Durkheim wrote, is antithetical to creating, sustaining the relationships that are vital to social bonds. Capitalism rewards those for whom relationships are transactional and temporary. Relationships under capitalism are mercenary. They are part of the scheme for personal advancement and require the oily manipulation of others. To advance in a capitalist system, it is necessary to build and then discard a series of ultimately hollow relationships. These empty relationships, and you can see them inside any corporation, contribute to the collective enemy and disintegration of social bonds. Now, capitalism may cater to a natural desire among many for self-enrichment, but you don't want this greed to dominate society. Capitalism rewards single-minded narcissists and often con artists, devoid of empathy and incapable of remorse. It rewards those focused exclusively on personal gain and self-aggrandizement. Once a capitalist class achieves complete control, as it has in the United States, it dismantles the structures that make social bonds possible, seeing in them an impediment to profit. The more concentrated wealth becomes, as with corporate capitalism, the more damage it inflicts on society, sending jobs to overseas sweatshops and leaving Americans underemployed or unemployed. Karl Marx saw alienation as a positive force, one that estranged workers from the means of production and moved them to question the structures of power, educate themselves about their exploitation, and ultimately revolt. But for Durkheim, this alienation or enemy is debilitating. It is, he wrote, a collective asthenia that drains us of energy and will. It manifests itself in self-loathing. We may indeed understand what is happening around us, Durkheim argued, but we lack the ability to free ourselves from the despair, frustration, and rage that cripple our lives. Our actions require an object outside of themselves, Durkheim wrote. It is not because we need to sustain the illusion of some impossible immortality. It is because it is implicit in our moral being, and it cannot be lost even partially, without that moral being losing its reason for existence. There is no need to demonstrate that in such a state of collapse, the slightest cause for depression can easily give rise to desperate acts. When life is not worth living, everything becomes a pretext for ridding ourselves of it. For individuals are too closely involved in the life of society for it to be sick. Without their being affected, Durkheim wrote, its suffering inevitably becomes theirs. Trump is not a product of the leak of the Podesta emails, or James Comey, or even racism, although he and many who support him are racist, or Russian bots. Demagogues always arise from failed democracies, plagued by rulelessness, by enemy. They tell an enraged population what it wants to hear, and crudely, to the delight of the betrayed, ridicule the elites who sold them out. Removing Trump from office without confronting the enemy that defines the lives of tens of millions of Americans would do nothing to restore democracy. In fact, it would probably consolidate the power of a Christianized fascism, rapidly filling Trump's ideological void. Vice President Mike Pence, because he is a creature of the Christian right, would most likely, as Noam Chomsky has pointed out, be worse than Trump if he gained the presidency. This enemy, as it always does, has empowered our own demagogues. And demagogues must be understood as cult leaders rather than traditional politicians. A disempowered population, infantilized by a world it cannot control, gravitates to cult leaders who appear omnipotent and promise a return to a mythical golden age. The cult leaders vow to crush the forces embodied in demonized groups and individuals which are blamed for their misery. The more outrageous the cult leaders become, the more they flout law and social conventions, the more they gain in popularity. Cult leaders are immune to the norms of established society. This is their appeal. Cult leaders demand a godlike power. Those who follow them grant them this power in the hope that the cult leaders will save them. Trump has transformed the decayed carcass of the Republican Party into a cult. And all cults are personality cults. They are extensions of the cult leader. The cult reflects the leader's prejudices, worldview, personal style, and idiosyncrasies. Trump did not create the yearning for a cult leader. Huge segments of the population, betrayed by the established elites, were conditioned for a cult leader. They were desperately looking for someone to rescue them and solve their problems. They found their cult leader in the New York real estate developer and reality television show star. And only when we recognize Trump as a cult leader, and many of those who support him as cult followers, will we understand where we are headed and how we must resist. It was 40 years ago this month that a messianic preacher named Jim Jones convinced or forced more than 900 of his followers, including roughly 280 children, to die by ingesting a cyanide-laced drink. Trump's refusal to acknowledge and address the impending crisis of ecocide and the massive mismanagement of the economy by the kleptocrats, his bellicosity, his threats against Iran and China, the withdrawal from nuclear arms treaties, along with his demonization of all who oppose him, ensure our cultural and, if left unchecked, physical extinction. Cult leaders are driven at their core by the death instinct, the instinct to annihilate and destroy rather than nurture and create. Trump shares many of the characteristics of Jones as well as other cult leaders, such as the founders of the Heaven's Gate cult, the Reverend Sun Young Moon, who led the Unification Church, and David Koresh, who led the Branch Davidian cult in Waco, Texas. Cult leaders are narcissists. They demand obsequious fawning and total obedience. They prize loyalty above competence. They wield absolute control. They do not tolerate criticism. They are deeply insecure, a trait they attempt to cover up with bombastic grandiosity. They are amoral and emotionally and physically abusive. They see those around them as objects to be manipulated for their own empowerment, enjoyment, and often sadistic entertainment. All those outside the cult are branded as forces of evil, prompting an epic battle whose natural expression is violence. A cult is a mirror of what is inside the cult leader, Margaret Singer wrote in Cults in Our Midst. He has no restraints on him. He can make his fantasies and desires come alive in the world he creates around him. He can lead people to do his bidding. He can make the surrounding world his world. What most cult leaders achieve is akin to the fantasies of a child at play, creating a world with toys and utensils. In that play world, the child feels omnipotent and creates a realm of his for a few minutes or a few hours. He moves the toy dolls about. They do his bidding. They speak his words back to him. He punishes them any way he wants. He is all powerful and makes his fantasy come alive. When I see the sand tables and the collections of toys some child therapists have in their offices, I think that a cult leader must look about and place people in his created world much as a child creates on a sand table a world that reflects his or her desires and fantasies. The difference is that the cult leader has actual humans doing his bidding as he makes a world around him that springs from inside his own head. George Orwell understood that cult leaders manipulate followers primarily through language, not force. This linguistic manipulation is a gradual process. It is rooted in continual mental chaos and verbal confusion. Lies, conspiracy theories, outlandish ideas and contradictory statements that defy reality and fact soon paralyze the opposition. The opposition, with every attempt to counter this absurdism with the rational, such as the decision by Barack Obama to make his birth certificate public, or by Senator Elizabeth Warren to release the results of her DNA test to prove she has Native American ancestry, plays to the cult leader. The cult leader does not take his or her statements seriously and often denies ever making them, even when they are documented. Lies and truth do not matter. The language of the cult leader is designed exclusively to appeal to the emotional needs of those in the cult. Hitler kept his enemies in a state of constant confusion and diplomatic upheaval, Joost Merlo wrote in The Rape of the Mind. They never knew what this unpredictable madman was going to do next. Hitler was never logical because he knew that that was what he was expected to be. Logic can be met with logic, while illogic cannot. It confuses those who think straight. The big lie and monotonously repeated nonsense have more emotional appeal in a Cold War than logic and reason, while the enemy is still searching for a reasonable counterargument to the first lie, the totalitarian can assault him with another. Cult leaders engage in the permanent lie. And the permanent lie is different from the falsehoods and half-truths uttered by politicians such as Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, or Barack Obama. The common political lie these politicians employed was not designed to cancel out reality. It was a form of manipulation. Clinton, when he signed into law the North American Free Trade Agreement, promised, and I'm quoting, "NAFTA means jobs, American jobs, and good-paying American jobs." George W. Bush justified the invasion of Iraq because Saddam Hussein supposedly possessed weapons of mass destruction. But Clinton did not continue to pretend that NAFTA was beneficial to the working class when reality proved otherwise. Bush did not pretend that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction once none were found. The permanent lie, however, is not circumscribed by reality. It is perpetuated even in the face of overwhelming evidence that discredits it. It is irrational. Those who speak in the language of truth and fact are attacked as liars, traitors, and purveyors of fake news. They are banished from the public sphere once totalitarian elites accrue sufficient power. The iron refusal by those who engage in the permanent lie to acknowledge reality, no matter how transparent reality becomes, creates a collective psychosis. The result of a consistent and total substitution of lies for factual truth is not that the lie will now be accepted as truth, and truth will be defamed as a lie, but that the sense by which we take our bearings in the real world and the category of truth versus falsehood is among the mental means to this end is being destroyed, Hannah Arendt wrote. The permanent lie is the apotheosis of totalitarianism. It no longer matters what is true, it matters only what is correct. And federal courts are being stacked with Federalist Society judges who served the correct ideology of corporatism and the rigid social mores of the Christian right. They hold reality, including science and the rule of law, in contempt. They seek to banish those who live in a reality-based world defined by intellectual and moral autonomy. Consistency is discarded. Complexity, nuance, depth, and profundity are replaced with the simpleton's belief in threats and force. This is why the Trump administration disdains diplomacy and is dynamiting the State Department. Totalitarianism, wrote the novelist and social critic Thomas Mann, is at its core the desire for a simple folktale. Once this folktale replaces reality, morality and ethics are abolished. And as Voltaire reminded us, those who can make you believe absurdities can make you commit atrocities. The cult leader grooms followers to speak in the language of hate and violence. The cult leader constantly paints a picture of an existential threat often invented that puts the cult followers in danger. Trump is doing this by demonizing the caravan of some 4,000 immigrants, most from Honduras, moving through southern Mexico. Caravans of immigrants are, in fact, nothing new. The beleaguered and impoverished asylum seekers, including many families with children, are 1,000 miles from the Texas border. But Trump, aided by nonstop coverage by Fox News and Christian Broadcasting, is using the caravan to terrify his followers, just as he, along with these media outlets, portrayed the protesters who flocked the U.S. Capitol to oppose the nomination of Kavanaugh as unruly mobs. Trump claims the Democrats want to open the border to these quote-unquote criminals and to quote-unquote unknown Middle Easterners who are, he suggests, radical jihadists. Christian broadcasting such as Pat Robertson's 700 Club splice pictures of marching jihadists in black uniforms cradling automatic weapons into video shots of the caravan. The fear-mongering and rhetoric of hate and violence, as I saw when I covered the war in the former Yugoslavia, eventually leads to widespread acts of violence against those the cult leader defines as the enemy. The explosive devices sent to Trump critics and leaders of the Democratic Party, including Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, and Joe Biden, along with George Soros, James Clapper, and CNN, allegedly by Cesar Sayoc, an ex-stripper and fanatic Trump supporter who was living out of his van, herald more violence. Trump, tossing gasoline on the flames, used this assault against much of the leadership of the Democratic Party to again attack the press, or as he calls it, the enemy of the people. It should come as no surprise that last Saturday, another enraged American white male, his fury and despair seemingly stoked by the diatribes and conspiracy theories of the far right, entered a Pittsburgh synagogue and massacred 8 men and 3 women as he shouted anti-Semitic abuse. Shot by police and arrested at the scene was Robert Bowers, who believes that Jewish groups are aiding the caravan of immigrants in southern Mexico. He was armed with a military-style AR-15 assault rifle plus 3 handguns. The proliferation of easily accessible high-caliber weapons, coupled with the division of the country into the blessed and the damned by Trump and his fellow cultists, threatens to turn the landscape of the United States into one that resembles Mexico, where at least 145 people in politics, including 48 candidates and pre-candidates, along with party leaders and campaign workers, have been assassinated over the last 12 months. Look south if you want a vision of the future. The cult leader, unlike a traditional politician, makes no effort to reach out to his opponents. The cult leader seeks to widen the divisions. The cult leader brands those outside the cult as irredeemable. The cult leader seeks the omnipotence to crush those who do not kneel in adoration. The cult followers, yearning to be protected and empowered, seek to give the cult leader unlimited power. Democratic norms and impediment to the leader's omnipotence are ridiculed, attacked, and ultimately abolished. Those in the cult seek to be surrounded by the cult leader's magical aura. Reality is sacrificed for fantasy, and those who challenge the fantasy are not considered human. They are satanic. Behavior that ensures the destruction of a public figure's career does not affect a cult leader. It does not matter how many lies uttered by Trump are meticulously documented by the New York Times or the Washington Post. It does not matter that Trump's personal financial interests, as we see in his relationship with the Saudis, take precedence over the rule of law, diplomatic protocols, and national security. It does not matter that he is credibly charged by numerous women with being a sexual predator, a common characteristic of cult leaders. It does not matter that he paid little or no income taxes and routinely committed financial fraud. It does not matter that he is inept, lazy, and ignorant. The establishment whose credibility has been destroyed because of its complicity in empowering the ruling oligarchy and the corporate state might as well be blowing soap bubbles at Trump. Their vitriol to his followers only justifies the hatred radiating from the cult. The removal of Trump from power, would not remove the yearning of tens of millions of people, many conditioned by the Christian right, for a cult leader. Most of the leaders of the Christian right have built cult followings of their own. These Christian fascists embraced magical thinking, attacked their enemies as agents of Satan, and denounced reality-based science and journalism long before Trump. Cults are a product of social decay, of anomie, and our decay and despair are expanding, soon to explode in another financial crisis. The efforts by the Democratic Party and much of the press, including CNN and the New York Times, to discredit Trump as if our problems are embodied in him alone are futile. The smug self-righteousness of this crusade against Trump only contributes to the national reality television show that has replaced journalism and politics. This crusade attempts to reduce a social, economic, and political crisis to the person of Trump. It is accompanied by a refusal to confront and name the corporate forces responsible for our failed democracy and growing social inequality. This collusion with the forces of corporate oppression neuters the press and Trump's mainstream and Democratic critics. Our only hope is to organize for the overthrow of the corporate state that vomited up Trump. Our democratic institutions, including the legislative bodies, the courts, and the media, are hostage to corporate power. They are no longer democratic. We must, like liberation movements of the past, engage in acts of sustained mass civil disobedience and non-cooperation. By turning our ire on the corporate state, we expose and name the true sources of power and abuse. We expose the absurdity of blaming our demise on demonized groups such as undocumented workers, Muslims, African Americans, Latinos, feminists, gays, and others. We give people an alternative to a Democratic Party that refuses to confront the corporate forces of oppression, a party which cannot be rehabilitated. We make possible the restoration of an open society. If we fail to embrace this militancy, which alone has the ability to destroy cult leaders, we will continue the march toward tyranny.
That was journalist Chris Hedges speaking about his new book, America, The Farewell Tour, recorded at the Sanctuary for Independent Media on November 3, 2018. Full audio and video of this talk, including the question and answer session that followed, is available online at mediasanctuary.org. You've been listening to a special holiday edition of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, which airs weekdays at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. Visit mediasanctuary.org for more information. Until next time.